Here we are. Welcome, Dylan. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great.
I appreciate you making the time to talk about your book, A Mind Forever Voyaging, A History of Storytelling and Video Games. I think I told you I heard about this through another book, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin. And in that, she's writing about a fictional game developer. A duo, actually, and their misadventures. And I'm kind of curious if you have maybe heard of or read that book at this point.
I haven't read it yet. I have heard of it. It's been recommended to me by multiple people, and I got to get on it. It's one of those things that I think still has a little bit of a hold list at the library. It's been very popular.
I'm kind of thinking they'll end up making a movie or like a
Oh, I think
series
it's
out of it or
inevitable.
something. So I kind of think you might be seeing like a resurgence of interest in your book as a result. If people do read it all the way to the end and they read that author's note at the end, you'll get those dedicated readers, which I hope that I hope I'm that.
No, I definitely, I, you know, it's funny. I was just doing my taxes. I put out this book, 13 years ago. And even then it was, sort of a small self-published thing. So this was never going to be a, I'm getting rich off a, book on video game history, right? But it's funny that I think the sales for 2023 were probably as strong or stronger than any other year, from what I saw. So,
Good for
yeah, they're
you.
still getting out there a little bit. I never expected it to have this life,
Your book, I think, is one of the probably the best that I've read. I mean, and I try to like read about this stuff. I'm not professional academic or anything, but I'm super interested in the topic, right? And storytelling in video games, it's something that you can find academic pieces, and you can find, I guess, a few popular sort of press type thing, like things for a general audience or whatever. And I feel like your book does a really nice job of taking from both of those worlds and kind of compiling something that makes a great case for games as a storytelling medium. So I guess, so real first question, I suppose, is how did you come to write this book? How did you get interested in that topic?
So I went to sort of a weird little college called Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. And it is a, if it's an alternative school, it's sort of like Evergreen in some ways, if you're familiar with that. And so part of that is that you design your own major. And one thing that's really nice about it is that they kind of assume you're probably going to switch majors. Or it'll change over time, right? It's not one of those things where you switch majors and it's like, oh, well, now you have to take another year. And so I started out doing basically a combination of political science and media studies. And as I went forward, I got more and more interested in the media studies parts of that, and particularly in how different mediums tell stories. And so I did everything from, I took literature classes and I took film classes, but I also took a modern dance class, and what I didn't really take were game studies classes, because at that time, they didn't really exist. They existed at a few places, like your places like DigiPen, where like that's the entire curriculum. But outside, there are game making programs, right? But outside of those few places, it just wasn't very present in the academy. But part of what Hampshire did is that there were lots of things that people studied that weren't present in the academy. So it kind of said, look, if you can talk a professor to sponsoring an independent study, you can do that. Go for it. And lots of people did that. So I there was one professor there, Chris Perry, who had been an early animator at Pixar. I believe he was technical director on A Bug's Life, and then taught animation there. And so that was his primary background. He had grown up playing games, and he knew some things about, storytelling with computers. And so there was some match there. And so he is actually another student who kind of talked me into doing the legwork of making an independent study. And so we had to make our own syllabus and kind of say, and it was basically on the subject. It was on storytelling and video games. And so we kind of zigged and zagged, and we wrote some different papers here and there. And my final paper, I don't even remember if it was a synthesis, it was something, but I ended up when you first start college, you're like, a 5-page, that's huge. How am I ever going to write 5 pages about this, right? And by the end of this independent study, I turned in this 40-page binder because it was too big to staple. Much to the chagrin of the poor, poor Chris, who'd volunteered to help sponsor this independent study, now had to read this thing. But it was like, oh, I can do this. This is something that I have, I can kind of, and I kind of developed the structure of, again, yeah, you play the game, you take detailed notes, you see what you have to say, and you do research, you see what else has been written on it. But the sort of object first approach, as opposed to like a theory first approach, which is what you did a lot in media, which, there's nothing wrong with, but it's just not how I think about this, I guess I would say.
Sure. No, I feel the same way. I wonder how, well, first of all, I guess I'm curious what was on your syllabus. Is it sort of the games that made it into the book or some of the ones that made it into your
Some
endnotes?
overlap. Deus Ex was definitely on there. And I'm trying to remember, the funny thing is that somewhere buried on my computer, I have a little college, like college year three, somewhere in here.
Yeah, I'd
I'm
love
just
to
seeing
host it
if
if it
I have,
exists.
yeah. So I think we called it Story Plane was the syllabus. Oh, yep, man, I have it right here. So let's see. So yeah, we played Deus Ex talking about oh, you know what? No, I'm jumping ahead here. So what Story Plane was, here it is. Here's the thing. So we made a unit that was about delivery of narrative, which is basically talking about what are the different ways games communicate their narrative elements. And we used Deus Ex as an example because at the time that was sort of the game, that's a throw everything at the wall game. Right. So you have cutscenes, but you also have dialogue, but you also have audio recordings, and you also read emails, and you also, get things visually communicated, and just any way they can do world building, they kind of use it in that game. So we broke that down, and then we did a section on kind of emergent gameplay, which again with Deus Ex. Then we did some things that were on more experimental, like interactive fiction. We did something from Emily Short. Kind of text adventures. We did Facade, which ended up being in the book, and a little game called The Majesty of Colors, which made a splash back then. It was like one of the first kind of art games when people were making kind of like very artsy like flash games. And then yeah, we jumped through a bunch of different things. I'm reading this now. I'm actually sort of impressed at like how much we put it. I remember writing a paper on Thief and kind of stealth gameplay. We wrote a little section on ones that like if you're kind of looking at the stream, something like Katamari Damacy, which is like very abstract.
Love that game.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Oh, man.
We did that and that went well. And then the next step was my final year at the way they structure it at Hampshire's, you kind of have 3 years where you're taking courses and doing more or less normal things, and your final year they call it Division 3, and you basically are taking one course a semester, and otherwise you're spending pretty much all your time on some big project, and maybe you're writing or directing a play, maybe you're doing scientific research, that's up to you, and you have a little committee of 2 to 3 professors who guide you on this. And for me originally I was like, well, I wrote these essays basically, why don't I write a series of linked essays all about different games and storytelling. And then very shortly after that, I'm like, oh, a series of linked essays, that's just called a book.
Can be,
It's
can
like
be.
trying to reinvent the book with this idea. And I was like, I want to do that because it just comes more. Yeah. So it just felt more natural to me. You want something that was large enough to take advantage of that space. And I just set myself a schedule that was, first I was like, I'm going to come up with a list of games. And what I decided from the beginning was that this isn't going to be the history of storytelling in video games, both because I'm young and I don't claim to be able to speak to that entire topic, and also because like that book would be 2,000 pages,
Perhaps.
that it's just the medium is now, if you wrote that book in 1990, you could probably talk about everything that's happened so far,
I
but
wonder,
we're But by 20, I was doing this in 2010, 2011, and by that point, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of video games all doing very different things. One thing I say about video games is it is the multimedium
Yes.
that, you can take. Obviously, there's a great diversity in, films and literature, but you can take two films and you can say, oh, these are using the same camera techniques, and a lot of the technical aspects of them, if you showed them to somebody who'd never seen films before, they would both look pretty similar. But you can take two video games and they don't look like they belong to the same medium. They
Right.
can just be radically different objects.
Right. I'm thinking of a game like Deus Ex or something like that that's immersive, that lets you do a lot of things versus a game like, I don't know, one of these early text adventures that you write
Or
about. Yeah.
Minesweeper,
Or
right?
Minesweeper, sure.
This is a world in which you can have, text adventure, pure text games, Deus Ex and Minesweeper, and this is just, we just all call this the same medium for
Kind
lack
of.
of a better
Yeah.
category to put them in.
Now, so I wonder about that. Part of the next follow-up question to, so how did you make your syllabus is sort of like, so then where does the theory come in as you're drawing on some of your media studies, perhaps? I don't know. You mentioned, I think, Barry Atkins is the name of one of the scholars that you do mention in the book, and you're clearly aware of like some of what's going on in that game studies world.
And Barry Atkins is an interesting example because this book is, I don't think it's really well remembered today, but he was somebody who, again, he wasn't a game study guy because game studies didn't really exist much at that time.
Yeah, very
He
few people.
was an English guy. He was a literary theory guy who played video games in his free time, and someday he convinced, his college to be like, give me a sabbatical, let me make my hobby, write a book.
I want that gig. Yeah, good
Yeah,
for him.
exactly. And so it is, in some ways, if you went back and read it today, there would be many things about it that would come off as sort of amateurish.
Sure.
This is certainly true of my book as well. And that
More
he's sort
guilty of
of
it.
poking around, and there's some game study stuff that he himself is like not aware of, and he's reinventing the wheel a little bit, but it is really trying to grapple with how do you read a game as a narrative? What does this mean? And of course, some of it is like, there's a lot of kind of B movie qualities to it. He wrestles with this where he has a chapter on Half-Life, and on one hand, Half-Life is the techniques it uses to tell its story are very sophisticated in many ways, and the story is like, something that you would kind of find at, watch at 2 a.m., on like a B movie thing. And there is like game studies do exist like here and there, kind of, but it's not really, there are people trying to make game studies happen there, but there, it's not like there's the game studies department of Harvard, right? It's a people here and there in media studies, in various forms of humanities, and in, what we might think of as more traditional computer studies. It's a very multidisciplinary approach. And I will say, spoilers, that this, it never really manifests. And initially it's about the ideas like, we just need to get the respect, we need to get the journals, we need to get this established. And I think what happens is just around the point where video games have been around long enough that people are like, okay, these deserve to be taken seriously, is when the humanities start kind of collapsing in the American
Interesting.
university system. Nobody's making a game studies department because nobody's making any new humanities departments.
I wish they'd sort of be a little bit more forward thinking on that, though, because I think if they made game studies departments, you'd see a lot of more interest in the humanities, wouldn't you?
And what's funny is like literally 2 years after I left, Hampshire hired a game studies professor. They basically got someone in, they put a bunch of board games in the library, and they started teaching that again as part of its sort of multimodal design. But I think, as with a lot of things, games are weird in that they're a medium where, you can learn to write and go and write a book, right? But games are more like films, where even if you study film, I mean, you can go and make a student film, but you can't just go and, have Hollywood give you $100 million and make a game. You will be, have some very specialist role in the production line,
With a few exceptions, I mean, so
with a few
leaping to mind
exceptions.
here, I don't know if you're familiar with like Undertale or Stardew Valley, these kinds of like amazing one-off, this person just sits down and makes this
And
game for them.
exactly. And those, like, as far as I'm concerned, like Eric Barone of who made Stardew Valley
Your
is,
neighbor, I
yeah, is
know.
not my neighbor, is, deserves all the success in the world because he is a great artist and a great composer and a great game designer and a great
Storytelling.
programmer. And, but that is not a fair ask of any human being, and the fact that there are all these people who do that always shocks me to no end. But for me, if I was to, people are like, oh, Dylan, Dylan, you like video games, you're gonna go into that. I'd be like, well, I can't code. And I'm a terrible artist. And these are really the two pillars, the main ways you get into game
Kind of
design, right?
important, yeah.
Obviously in games there are designers, there are producers, there are, marketing people, there's all sorts of things. But if you're just starting out in the industry, animation, something in the animation modeling art or in coding implementation is probably where you're going to start. Again, unless you are, but even a lot of the really great independent game designers, many of them started out working at large studios, learned some skills, then went independent.
Go indie, yeah. And your book comes out sort of at the early stages of that indie boom, and you write about that a little bit. I'm curious. I mean, it's been a decade. What have you been up to? Have you been playing a lot of games? I
Oh
mean,
yeah. And what's funny is that, I would say, the book itself is probably like kind of 50-50 on PC and console games.
roughly, yeah.
And these days, I mean, the last console I bought was a PlayStation 3, and unfortunately, it just died. It just breathed its final
R.I.P.
breath.
PS3.
And that's because not because I dislike console games, but because, back in the day, you'd be like, well, I'm all out of games to play on my PlayStation 2, and nothing good has come out on PC, so I guess I'll get a GameCube. And now there's like just a fire hose of games on the PC. Almost everything comes to it that I've never really felt the need. I mean, I try to, there's some small part of me that still thinks I can keep up and play all the important games, but it's clearly impossible. I mean, that's it was impossible back in 2011, and now I think I just saw that the number of games that came out on Steam in 2023 was 14,400.
Too many to play them all.
Yeah, and even if you say 90% of those are student games and people figuring things out, you would still have, 1,400 and change like proper games, which is great because now as we've gotten to a point where there is a game for everybody. Kind of no matter what your interest or what your niche is, or there's a game out there that's for you. Finding it is another matter, but it exists.
Well, this kind of brings us to the question of, choosing. Your book is about choice, right?
Yeah,
That's a
yeah.
big sort of theme throughout the book. The way that games are special is that they allow for the player to interact and choose certain things with the narrative, the gameplay, obviously, the
Yeah.
experience they want to have. And then it comes to this question of sort of canonicity, if you want to put a,
Yeah.
highfalutin name on it, or just like how do you choose the games you play and how do you balance the time you're going to put into any given game?
Yeah.
And so as you say, you're pretty even-handed in the book, at least between different genres, different
Yeah.
consoles versus PC. And so I guess I'm wondering, I couldn't really tell like what kinds of games you actually prefer to just play, like for fun.
Yeah.
And maybe you just kind of like thinking about games as such. So
I like to jump around a lot. I would say my heart, like my real happy place is our role-playing games and adventure games.
Right on.
Like if it's my kind of, like just a good point and click adventure if I want something sort of, more conservative and traditional and really, whether it's like old isometric role-playing games, I replayed all the Baldur's Gate games
Oh,
in
you do
preparation
mention
for Baldur's
that,
Gate 3 and
Nice.
in the last year and or even more the more modern first person role-playing games. I like those. But I like puzzle games, I like weird experimental games. I like, I love a good co-op game if something that can really work in that format. I do like to jump around. And I think it is, what you kind of say about the rise of indies. I really think, Steam comes out in 2004, but it's not really being actively used by third parties until roughly 2008-ish. That's like when it really starts to get a significant number of releases. And sometimes people have asked me, are you thinking about writing a part two? Because this book is 13 years out of date.
Come on,
And I kind of say I couldn't because here, I'm making some arguments about what should be included in the canon. And some of them, like, I said Facade, and today Facade, if it's remembered at all, is a weird curiosity. But I also said Dear Esther, which when I wrote this book was still just a mod. It wasn't, didn't even have its standalone release. And now is this, incredibly famous foundation of a genre.
Right, the
So
walking
I
sim,
think that,
right?
yeah, that's probably the thing I feel most happy about. And in fact, it's actually very hard to find people, anyone writing about the original version of it, which does have some differences.
That's one of the games. So, I mean, I've heard of that's one that I've heard a lot about. Never sat down and really watched a playthrough or tried to play it. But after reading your book, that's now pretty high on my list of things. Like, oh, if I care about these topics, if I, particularly the incorporation of this like scriptural thing that's happening, it sounds
And
like.
it's like this, it has like a semi-randomized narrative, and it kind of traffics in ambiguity, but it also is really like the core question was, what if you made a first-person shooter that had no shooting? What
Right,
if
the
you just
absence of
removed
violence,
the core mechanic from a genre? What would be left?
which is tantalizing to think about, right? Because in some sense, that is one of the great bugbears or something, like the problem with games. There's many, there's lots, but that's got to be one of the big ones is the problem of violence, what it means to spend so much time playing these violent games, and what's that doing to our culture, et cetera, et cetera. But so, I guess, yeah, if you were to write a second part, which I guess you've said, okay, there's difficulty with that. What are some of the games that would possibly make it into that, like more recent games that you've been enjoying?
Someone, I want to see if I can pull this up. Someone asked me that on Twitter
Mm.
some time ago, like probably two different times, and
So you've given it some thought.
I've given it some thought, but I think one of the issues that if you think one, I'm kind of trying to balance looking at things that were novel and interesting, whether or not they had any real historical influence. But I'm mostly trying to look at things where you can say, oh, this influenced this, and you can really draw lines. And as
Right.
more and more games come out every year, there are many games doing amazing and interesting things with storytelling. But I would say that on one hand, the differences year to year are smaller because it's a more mature medium, and a lot of the obvious things that nobody has tried have now been tried. And on the other hand, there's just so many games that even other game developers struggle to play all the games.
Oh, of
And
course,
so
yeah.
what counts as influential is much more disparate. And every once in a while, and often in some ways more commercial, like one thing that happened is like, Vampire Survivors came out and was its own little take on the shoot 'em up genre. And now there's a whole genre of survivors likes
Oh,
where
yeah.
everyone's racing to make their own little Vampire Survivors knockoff game. But that's rare. It doesn't happen much. And more often you'll see games that are, what if we took game A and game B and game C and mushed them together? And these are all worth writing about and examining, but it's very hard to find a game where you say, this is the moment where this big thing happened
Yeah.
and it did this thing that no one had ever done before.
That's
And
fair, that's fair.
even something like, I would say that if I wrote a book today, like Disco Elysium is
Okay.
really interesting and does a lot of unusual things with the structure of the RPG and what character skills are, what it means to role play a character. And even that is very much built on the foundations of something like Planescape Torment.
Ah, that's one that makes it into your end notes. Yeah. Is that where the planes title for the syllabus came from?
I
What's it?
believe so. Yeah.
Story plane? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I thought there might be a D&D thing going on there.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, while you're looking for
Yeah.
the list, I haven't again haven't played Disco Elysium. Like to lay my cards on the table, I kind of stopped playing new games around the time your book came out,
Yeah.
probably, or even before when I was in college. I just did other things and I got into reading and all, travel. And so I play new games now because I have kids and I want to, play games with them. So we're playing Mario Wonder.
Oh,
We're
wonderful.
playing the new Zelda games on the Switch, and they're awesome. But the games that I really love, are from my childhood, the Earthbound, the Chrono Trigger of that era, the FF7, the Xenogears. Those ones, I feel like I'm almost too close to like objectively write about, so though I aspire to and analyze them, I end up just sort of appreciating them and being weird about them at great length. So
I will also say, as an example, if you've never read, have you read Final Fantasy VII in Oral History?
I saw that came out, and I did delve into a bit of that.
It's
I didn't read it
enormous,
too carefully. Yeah.
but it's very good. Yeah, and it's very rare to have that level of insight into how a game was made.
So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of rich territory just looking at even individual games, right? Especially these JRPGs where the developers, because of the trade secrets involved, to this day won't really say like how the game was made. You know, they're under these non-disclosure contracts or whatever equivalent is in Japan in the companies that they work for. But like you could look at a single aspect of some of those games, the music, the storytelling, and you could write a book about that easily because I mean, I think these are just great works of art, and there's inexhaustible when you start to look at them. So I don't know. I don't want to pressure you or anything, but I would love to see more, you know, more of your writing because you do have such a great grasp of sort of the overarching context and trends that are behind some of this stuff.
And I will say one good thing that has happened is that, shortly after I wrote this book, I wrote for a little website called Nightmare Mode, and it was very scrappy, and we were just kind of doing similar things, trying to write, little bits of history or takes or talking about, the politics of this, or just exploring games in ways that were not really getting coverage on the sites that were really just, preview review news.
Right.
And in the decade since, that I think I stopped doing that in 2013. But online games writing has exploded to a significant degree. And then I would say secondarily, some of that energy has been lost, like YouTube, but that has been taken up not just by streaming in general, but by like YouTube video essayists who will go and like, there are YouTubers who will say, okay, I'm going to play every single Nintendo game ever made, whether they're good or bad, and have a long-running dialogue on this. And it's not, not quite the same thing as having an essay, but the level of exploration of so many aspects of games and games culture, I would say, is in some ways bigger than it's ever been. And what can
Oh,
be,
yeah.
you can look up a YouTube video that's something like really obscure and really into the history of this super duper obscure game no one cares about, and it will have 60,000 views. And you'll be like, I don't know, where were all these people? But it's a culture that has, I think, values its own history more than it used to. Even if companies aren't as good at preserving it, they're still better than they used to be, which because they used to just throw it all away.
That's right. The preservation area is definitely one that has some real institutional heft,
But there you're
although
seeing a
there's
lot
few, yeah.
more remakes and remasters, and there's commercial reasons for that, but it also is an industry that is, games often age a lot, and without, a certain amount of appreciation for much older graphics and game design ideas, it can be hard to return to those if you didn't grow up with them.
Yeah, so that's where I guess a book like yours makes a lot of sense to see maybe by working backwards in a way, right? Where do some of these techniques and things have their roots? And so just to sort of turn to the book for a little bit here, as mentioned, you've got sort of text adventures as one major piece of it kind of early on, and you talk about Monkey Island. Secret of Monkey Island in particular was like a sort of a formative experience for you, the way you portray it in the book at least. So I wish you'd say a little bit about that, you know, like how do you feel about the Secret of Monkey Island looking back at that?
I still love it. I mean, there's some things like that. And I think what's funny, I didn't know this at the time, right? I love The Secret of Monkey Island because it was probably the first game I ever played that wasn't like, a children's multimedia CD-ROM. And if that first game had just been steaming hot garbage, I probably would love it anyway. But as it turns out, the first adventure game I played was also arguably the most important adventure game in the medium because if you go, I did later go back and I tried to play some of the Sierra games with their often just incredibly obtuse puzzles and their really eagerness to kill you or to have you get 75% of the way through the game and be like, oh no, you didn't pick up that item in scene one. You're forever locked out of finishing the game. And Monkey Island really trying to say, video games can be fun and funny, and you can make them challenging, but you don't screw the player. And I would say that that's the big thing that really separates games, I would say, of the 70s and 80s and some of the 90s and more modern game design, for better and for worse, is that you never screw the player out of victory. Now, sometimes that means there's less reactivity and less consequences. One thing I say with the sequel to Deus Ex, Human Revolution, which came out a little bit after this book, it's a great game in many ways, but it has less emergent gameplay because to a lot of people, what I call emergent gameplay, you just call a bug. You say, this is broken. This isn't working how it's supposed to work. And so I guess there's been some shifting there where games have become much more accessible in ways that are generally, I would say, generally a positive thing. But sometimes they lose a little bit of the jank and edge. But even then, there's so many throwback games. Like if you want to play RPGs that are, unhelpful and difficult, just like they were in 1984, like there are studios that are just making those games,
They cater to that audience for
that are
sure.
catering to that audience. Absolutely.
So then, yeah, so there's, I mean, each of the games that you touch on, it sort of brings at least one major innovation to the art of game design and of storytelling in video games. One of them, to talk about a pretty much unplayable game, I guess you mentioned Ultima 4. Being like one of the tougher ones for you to like get through for the
It's
book.
real hard. And I will say, like, if I did not have the modern internet where I could go and look things up, I would never have finished Ultima 4. Because there's a lot of things like that where, like, oh, like to finish the game, you have to start a bunch of fights and run away and not fight anyone to up your, like, moral valor, or I don't even remember which stat it is, right? Things. And I think that's a big difference is that there's, if I recommend it one thing for people to read, it would be The Digital Antiquarian, which is a ongoing blog by a guy named Jimmy Marr, who basically starting with the history of early computing and going as far as he can go until he gets tired of it, which right now is, I think he's in 98, 97 or
Oh, not
1998.
bad at all.
No, I mean, this thing is, if you printed this out, this thing would probably be 14,000 pages at this point. I mean, it's very much more than I ever did, and really
Holy
this
moly.
kind of Herculean project. And doing a very good job of almost any given year focusing on, again, primarily, I think he restricts himself to computer games just for scope reasons and his interest, but games that did something interesting with storytelling in that year, and then really going also and looking at the technical aspects and how, computers of the era and what's happening with Windows or the internet or whatever is informing these games and going on these sort of side journeys.
That's cool. You mentioned also in the book Tristan Donovan's replay history, which
And that was a great resource for me,
really
and I
good.
think is still probably the single greatest single, like, tome for video game history.
I think
And
I
it
agree.
has the only issue with it is the one that I kind of mentioned, which is that if you're writing a single video game volume, you can really tell a good story in one book up to about the mid-90s. And then things just, so many games start coming out, so much starts happening that you just run out of ability to cover it. And at that point, you have to say, I'm writing a book about strategy games, or I'm writing a book about romance and video games, or some aspect, because there's just too much.
We're maybe still too close to see what will prove, of lasting. I don't know. I mean, or
It's
maybe
hard.
our notion of what lasting value is itself antiquated here. I'm not
You
sure.
know, you know, and I think people will rediscover it. I mean, like, Baldur's Gate 3 is, the great success story of the last year. It has sold a bazillion copies. And what's interesting is that it has sold so many copies that you can say for certain that at least 90% of these people have never played a Baldur's Gate game before, because it has sold more than all the previous Baldur's Gate games combined by a factor of 10, and so on one hand, it's sort of bringing an existing thing to a new audience, but of course, some percentage of those people are going to be like, well, what's this 3? And
Let's
they're
go
going to go
back.
back and play Baldur's Gate. And some of them will be like, this is terrible and unplayable. But some of them will be like, oh, this is really cool. And it goes, well, the
Excellent.
example I think is the most, and I don't know if you've played this, is Final Fantasy VII Remake,
I haven't played the remake, but I love that it exists, just
Yeah.
so that people will come back and look at the
Right. And
original.
what's very interesting about the remake, without spoiling too much about it, it assumes that you have played Final Fantasy VII, even though they know that a lot of new people are going it, and it plays with that knowledge.
Right, it
And
changes
so
little
it's
things.
it and yeah.
And
And
big
so
things, I guess, yeah.
it's really is like trying to make remake. It's almost a remake that's about being a remake and remaking itself for a new generation.
Wow.
No.
I think this is a fair kind of intermission point, maybe, if we'd like to continue another time, if
Yeah,
that's good for
my
you.
schedule is pretty flexible.
Cool. And yeah, maybe we can just sort of pick up with the I was about to talk about Metal Gear
Yeah, that'd
Solid.
be a great place to pick
I think
up.
that's the thing that's making me think about next. So okay, welcome back. A couple days later now in our timeline. So I think that the last thing we were about to say was something about Metal Gear Solid and its sequel, Metal Gear Solid 2, and the ways that those games kind of made an impact in their time and then have had this kind of lasting influence. That's gone on.
I think the Metal Gear Solid games are, they're of all the games in this book, those are games that you could really just go and write a whole nother book about. There's a lot to them, and one of the weird things about them is that they're weird, which is to say that these are big, sort of big budget, increasingly big budget as the series goes on, mainstream games that, everyone was playing and were on the cover of magazine titles, and usually the bigger you go, the more sort of ordinary and conservative you get. And yet everyone, people who love these games and people who hate these games, will both agree that they are really idiosyncratic and strange and messy. And that is usually traced to the director and creator and writer Hideo Kojima, and kind of seeing him as an auteur. And I will say that I'm someone who I think often auteur theory isn't a great fit for video games when you're having 300 people making a thing, but it really does seem to stick with him that you could give me a game blind and not tell me who made it, and I'd be like, oh, this is a Kojima game, isn't it? Look at this dialogue. This is insane,
He had made games before, though, which
he
you also point
had.
out, right? This itself, Metal Gear Solid, is the sequel to previous games that most people hadn't played
Yeah, they had
outside
kind of a
Japan.
cult following, and I think they were the second one hadn't even been released in the United States. They were for a computer system, the MSX, that never really came out in the United States, and he definitely was aware of that with these games, which is why these are the first games I can think of playing. I'm not going to say that no one else had done this, but to have an extensive previously on
Okay.
where you can go and you can watch all these essentially security camera footage of Snake being briefed on the mission, and which of course goes through all his previous stuff as well.
It.
These games love exposition, which is a very strange thing to say about games that are at their core action games or stealth action games, one of the many. But the reasons I put them in my book, even though I thought they're very interesting and odd in all these ways, was that, and this is something, if I went back and I wrote this again, I would emphasize this more, but a lot of, if you look at video games and storytelling, the late 80s to the late 90s and even further are all about games trying to be movies to a large degree.
Right, yeah.
And games, instead of being, what do we do with this newfound power of choice, interactivity, and all these new forms? Just being like, man, we really want the recognition that Hollywood has. We want the money and the glory. And, they sure tell good stories. And how can we be like them? And
Yes.
a lot of the attempts to do that end up not working. Like, most famously, the FMV games of the 90s, where usually what you end up with is a bad movie and a bad game, all in one. And if you took the seventh guest and you screamed it in a cinema, it would be, it would be booed out of the theater. And so what Metal Gear Solid does is not come and tell the greatest story ever told, but really understands the language of cinema.
Yeah.
It understands how to use camera work. It understands how to use pacing. And it works, and it understands how to make something that is both intellectual and popular. At that say, in the same way, it's sort of like a smart thriller, right? Where on one hand, it's goofy villains, giving their big villain speeches before you fight them. On the other hand, it's long discussions about nuclear disarmament.
And all kinds of like weird philosophical, political. I know you mentioned you'd studied politics as well, so I don't know how much of that you kind of dug into. But there's a lot of, I think the Assassin's Creed games are kind of similar in a way. Another set of games I haven't actually played, but I've heard people talk about, and I know they have a lot of that kind of philosophical stuff and
And they're
meta stuff, but I
similar.
don't know.
Yeah, they're similar in that on one hand, they're very interested in history, and there's enormous depth of historical research that goes into making the games and sculpting their places. And on the other hand, they spend a lot of time is about you're stabbing the super conspiratorial Templar bad guys, There's like these two halves of it. And Metal Gear Solid is very much like that. I would say that one thing that distinguishes Metal Gear Solid and becomes even more apparent in later games is how self-aware it is.
Yes.
Most dumb video games don't really know that they're dumb video games, or at least won't admit to it. And Metal Gear Solid, it's one of the first games where, diegetic characters, your commanding officer will call up Snake, you have to press X to crouch, Snake. Right? It's just not even pretending that this isn't a video game, but everyone's very serious about it.
Yes. You cite in a footnote, I want to say, Tim Rogers talking about mother games. Those again are kind of my bread and butter, especially Earthbound. And it does some similar things where there's players, or sorry, characters, NPCs in the game who talk about playing Earthbound and how it's kind of tough and it's delightful, right?
Yes, and those
But
games have the same very playful quality to them, right? It's a there's a kind of a and not in like a smug way, but in kind of like, oh, we're all having fun here, aren't we? Aren't video games sort of crazy?
So I'm curious about the I think that that's a really important piece of what you're saying, like the coming of age of games as a medium has to do with understanding that cinema and cinematic techniques might be incorporated but aren't something necessarily to aspire to as if it was a higher form, but something that can be brought into the things that make games particular and unique. And high quality in their own right.
And the Metal Gear Solid series is something of a lightning rod for these discussions. Certainly, the main they've made more sense, but like the core series is 1998 till 2008. And the entire time it's out there, there's one group of people that says these games are doing exactly the sins of the FMV games. They have long, long cutscenes. Metal Gear Solid 4 famously, like the ending of the game is like a 40-minute cutscene. They just like straight up put a movie in there, and then these other people say, okay, but these games actually have, very good gameplay, and that they incorporate the narrative into that gameplay in ways that is meaningful, that they do allow you to kind of explore and mess around. Each of them is essentially linear, but each of the levels has a lot of different ways you can progress in through, and like secrets to find and just sort of things to monkey around with. When the Metal Gear Solid 2 demo comes out, there's a lot of people who just play the demo over and over because they're
That's
like,
right.
oh, I can shoot out the chandelier glasses and those make a noise and those distract the guard. And oh, this model's these physics. And oh, I can hide in this locker and there's different posters inside the lockers. And
I remember that. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
yeah. That was fascinating because it was such a misdirection, right? You're playing as Snake for that first bit of the game. And then, of course, the whole rest of the game, when the full game comes out, you're playing as this whole other character, sort of
And I
disappointing for
think
people.
what is maybe unique about Metal Gear Solid 2 is that, again, it's the first big budget game I can think of that says pretty much explicitly, we are not going to give players what they want.
Oh yeah.
Because nobody, that's not how you make money, nobody does that, right? If I play an Assassin's Creed game, I know I'm going to get to play, however it starts, I'm going to get to play a really cool assassin, and he's going to get to stab a bunch of people, and I'll get to do backflips and whatever, right? And And then, yeah, and then you're placed into a character who's is explicitly designed. You know, Snake is macho and Raiden is effeminate. Snake is a
Yeah.
veteran, Raiden is a rookie, right? Snake is confident, Raiden doesn't know what he's doing. Snake takes everything stoically, Raiden whines about everything. You know, just like going out of its way to make a character who's not a bad character, but that
Yeah.
is sort of the opposite of this character that's established.
It messes with that power fantasy that so many games like Assassin's Creed, of course, yeah, and so many are very much unquestioningly feeding into. And I think there's something, again, to that, with respect to the game medium being about choice in a way and participation up to a point. But of course, it's within certain systems that have been set for the player. And a lot of times it is basically linear. And what you're doing that's different from playthrough to playthrough is a lot more to do with what's sort of your imagination and your exploration and your experience as a result of that. And so I guess I think that's a core thing that comes through in your book, that whole theme of games aspiring to be like cinema or to incorporate cinematic qualities. And then this tension with that of, but also, player choice, player action really having an effect on the game. And sometimes not really, but at least having an impact on the players themselves or their experience of the game.
And I would say that, you know, one thing that, like, of course, after writing this book, I went and I read more game studies and more theory. And I know that there's a lot of academics who, if I kind of gave them this book, they would view it as sort of amateurish and naive, which in some ways it is because of the focus of, you know, they say choice is just a small part of it, right? The games are almost like there is the player choice, but so much of it is about constructing this elaborate, you know, liminal space, however you want to use it, like to games, and this is something I've come back to more and more, is that games are spaces first and story second, even when they're narrative oriented,
I like that a
because
lot.
of the way time works, because of how, and that's why I think one thing that games are really good at is world building. And there's a lot of, you know, role-playing games and franchise that really, if you think of something like Fallout, right?
True.
The first Fallout game, you know, the plot is fine, but that's not what people remember. What people remember is this vivid setting. And one thing that games allow you to do is to explore that setting at a granular level. So
Yeah.
the idea of, you know, post-apocalyptic wasteland is not new, but Fallout says, how do you travel across this wasteland?
Yeah.
How do you get food and ammunition? How do you survive? How do you make friends or enemies with the people in this, right? And that is really fleshes out that setting in a way that just reading a novel about it maybe wouldn't.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, there's subsequent games that people will play without doing anything sort of like with the story at all. They just want to be in the world. They just want to like find food and scavenge and this and that. And that's like their experience of the game, and
Well,
that's.
and I think, I know you mentioned playing like the newer Zelda games, like Breath of the Wild. And I think that's very much what Breath of the Wild is doing, is that what
Oh,
story
very
is there
much.
is very minimal, but it wants you to inhabit this world and explore this world and sort of revel in the small details of this world, like cooking food.
Yes, I love the cooking food mechanics so much. Or finding the little hidden guys, little Koroks that pop out, and they're like, "You found me."
Exactly.
So that I guess the world building thing makes me think, of course, of Final Fantasy VII as well, which again is kind of a central hinge point in your book. You got the kind of the Metal Gear chapters and the Final Fantasy VII chapter. Those were ones that I could really kind of grab onto a bit because I feel like I know those games a bit better, particularly FF7. I've like played a couple times through and thought a lot about, and I approach it from a kind of, again, like a philosophical, how is it using certain ideas about climate and nuclear disaster. But also things about personality and identity and certain mythic themes that keep coming up in the Final Fantasy games, often just in the form of like a reference in the name of something or things like that, right? And so that's an aspect of the game that cinema has a hard time conveying, I think, because it is sort of a compressed and focused story. you can pull those things up, but in the space of a video game, you have just way more time and freedom, maybe not in the sense of changing the story, but freedom in the sense of letting the story unfold.
Right.
Where I think those kinds of, again, they might be a little bit of a stretch to suppose that most players are going to really get into that, but it's there. You can go back to it and explore some of those things, like the whole idea of materia as the life force of the planet. That's a really cool change, really, to the kind of crystals that had been there before. It's a
Right.
really interesting way of amplifying what's that like mean, like what's it mean? So that was a thing. I guess as I was reading your book, I liked that the openness to interpretation is really maintained, because maybe because you only have like a short space to talk about each game,
Yeah.
you're not going to try to like dig in so much to each little thing.
Yeah, because
That's for
again,
other
you could
people.
write a book on Final Fantasy VII easy. I would say that for me, like I'm very fond of it. If someone said, "What is the best game narrative?" I might not say Final Fantasy VII, but if someone said, "What is the most game narrative?" I would say Final Fantasy VII. Because
It was a
literally,
big,
like you can just play like theme bingo or our fantasy trope bingo, and it's in Final Fantasy VII.
It's going to be there.
As it, you just go from the mini games to all the locations to all the characters to like the all the subplots, and you can make this crazy chart about. I have this really specific memory of when I was in fifth grade, I traveled to Belize for 2 weeks, and the first week was really nice, and the second week was actually kind of boring. I spent a lot of time in a hotel, and to entertain myself, I literally thought about the subplots of Final Fantasy VII and tried to sort of map them out in my brain. Oh, this character is related to this character. Who knew this character? Just as like a little mental exercise. There's a lot there.
So the sequel, as you talked about, or rather the remake,
Yeah.
sort of digs into that element of, okay, there's all these things about the game that players, loved, have thought, maybe overthought about.
Right.
And so let's actually blow this up and not just make a faithful, quote unquote,
Right.
remake with the updated graphics and et cetera, let's play around with
Yeah.
those player expectations. Again, something that MGS2 kind of does maybe first
Yes.
or most dramatically, and then its influence is felt this much later.
And I think they realize pretty early on, they have this early idea of doing an episodic, like releasing small episodes or something. But they realize very early on, and why they're so resistant to the easy money of remaking Final Fantasy VII is that that game operates on a very abstract level, right? There will be an entire town that's represented by one screen, right? Just one camera shot. And in a, a modern game where you're modeling everything with a 3D camera, you can rotate that you can't do that. And so they say, wow, if we were to remake this game, it would be hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars and take us 10 years, And so that leads to them splitting the game into three parts, which is what they've done now, and selling each of those for $70. And on one hand, that leads to them zooming in and maybe having bloat and having very minor characters develop their entire plot lines or whatever. But it is ultimately a game in a world that can support that because there's so much there that's implied and suggested. And I mean, whether you want to go that deep, and maybe you didn't want to find the whole backstory of, Zack Fair and whatever,
Oh,
but it's
we'd
there.
want
Yeah, but exactly. No, we
to.
do. The opportunity is there. And I think it's another game that I think from a remove is kind of a weird game in a lot of ways. And a lot of people who played it, that was their first JRPG or just their first RPG period. They had never played a game like this before, and yet captured so many imaginations,
I think that is one area of the video game medium that has definitely changed a lot over time. Like, you're writing the book and you include like an index at the end of like terminology, which arguably is still necessary because so many of those things have changed so much in this short amount of time. But on the other hand, games are a little bit more pervasive now. So what you're describing, your experience, my experience growing up with these games kind of coming onto the scene, that's happened. And so now there's a kind of different like givens about video games that most people just sort of
Absolutely. I mean,
they
and
know
the
about them.
big difference, and this is not an original observation, but the big difference is generational. That, when I was when I you and I are growing up, the term gamer might mean something because maybe most of our peers maybe didn't play video games, right? It was something that, in the same way that most people, you might be a lacrosse player and most people don't play lacrosse or whatever, right? Whereas today, it would be weird if a kid hadn't played Minecraft or Fortnite. They're so normative. And they may not know about the history of the medium, and they may not know what Final Fantasy VII is or whatever. But you ask them, oh, what's the DPS on that weapon? And they'll be like, oh, it's 47, and are in Minecraft. They'll talk to you about crafting terminology. I mean, you can talk to 8-year-olds about Minecraft, and I literally have talked to like an 8-year-old who knew console commands on how to spawn different things in Minecraft. And I'm just like, man, the depth of knowledge that people have about these games, though it is increasingly a smaller number of widely played games versus the sort of cornucopia of games that maybe most people didn't play.
So in thinking about like how this would connect with education, I guess. I don't know if that's something that you're still interested in, since this kind of came out of an educational frame, really, like an assignment almost, right? And is that something that you think, so that that this book would be a good like entree into that, or would you want to, I don't know, think about teaching video games in some other way? I'm just curious.
I mean, I think it's valuable. I mean, this is always the question whenever you're teaching any aspects of the arts. There's a big people who say, well, why? Why is it important for me to know about novels that people wrote in the past that I'm not going to read? And there's that larger question of the humanities and kind of its place. But insofar as, of course, I believe that these things have value. Like, I think absolutely video games, should be taught, at least given as electives, in the same way we do with films and literature and theater. And I think there is, the reason that anyone's still buying my little book, which is, I mean, it has its merits, but is, as like it was written 12 years ago. There, ideally, in an ideal world, it would be far out of date, and there would have been 100 books kind of that took its place since then. And they're just, I mean, part of it is there's no money in it, but it's also just not. I think with the shifting media landscape, video games have always been a place where almost all the writing about video games comes from the internet, lives on the internet, dies on the internet, and then increasingly in video or maybe short TikTok essays or whatever, our stream commentaries. And that is, those things are more ephemeral and harder to incorporate in a classroom. It's often when I think about today, when we think about not just what is this game, but what do people think about this game, right? I could go, if I wanted to, I could go on to, Usenet or archive the internet forums and be like, here's what people were thinking about Final Fantasy VII. With a game today, it's all on Discord and Twitter and things that may or may not be around or accessible or searchable in the long term.
Interesting. I wonder how that connects then with one of the big problems I think about when it comes to teaching games is just how quickly they become dated, and the systems that they're on
Become, hard to
are not
access.
accessible, such that like a copy of Earthbound is like the holy grail, to actually have a working copy of Earthbound on a Super Nintendo. And I know that you can obviously like, just like play the game on your computer or whatever, you can just do that. But it's not ideal to have to like tell your students, oh, just pirate that so you can play it for a class.
It's not ideal, and it's in some ways not the, I mean, not that you can ever really recreate the experience people had,
But it's
but
different.
it's further away. And it is, but it's true that, when we talked last time a little bit about the industry not doing a great job of preservation, piracy has done 95% of the work that has been done. And if emulation and piracy didn't exist, as most of the industry wished it hadn't, we would have lost 90% of the games that are out there. Because they're just, and in fact, there's been a number of times where Nintendo's been like, oh, we're re-releasing this on the Switch. And people dig into the files, and Nintendo just went and got ROMs off the internet because they didn't have the files anymore. They didn't preserve them from 30 years ago. Or that was just easier than reprogramming it. It's It is really important. But yeah, something like Earthbound, like I played Earthbound because they released it on the SNES Mini, which was a great thing. But
Right,
then they
yes.
decided that that was limited edition and you can't get that anymore. It's kind of this Nintendo has a little bit of a Disney Vault approach to their, video games published on their platforms.
Yeah.
And it is, and but it's also like emulation is great, but there's a reason why it's really easy to emulate, pretty much any Super Nintendo game. But if you want to emulate PS3 games, even though these games are now, God, I'm feeling old now. Some of them are 19 years old. A lot of them you can, because it's a much more complex, bespoke piece of hardware that is just would require trying to brute force emulating it requires more powerful computers than we normally have today.
Interesting.
And so, like, I was thinking about my PS3 recently died, and I was actually thinking about playing through the Metal Gear Solid games with a friend.
Yeah.
And I was just being like, oh, we can, I'm sure we can just emulate these. And I was like, oh, wait, no, the PS1 one has a few issues. Both the PS2 ones actually have issues in emulation.
Oh.
And Metal Gear Solid 4 is basically just, you almost can't do it without severe issues.
That's a bummer. So
Yeah. And
then
so, like, those are probably prominent enough that they'll be kept in circulation.
yeah.
Though who knows? Like Metal Gear Solid 4, there's an iPod in it, right? And sometimes they might be like, oh, we can't republish that because we don't have the licensing agreement with Apple, anymore.
Oh, that's
This
weird.
often drowns games where the game had a soundtrack and the soundtrack had there's a you had it for 10 years or whatever, and then they can't re-release it because they don't have the soundtrack anymore.
That's crazy. Yeah, then it's almost like the next best thing then does have to turn into a kind of cinematic experience of watching
Right.
someone's playthrough with or without commentary, however you want to approach it, but that's just not the same experience at
No,
all.
exactly. And when I was doing this archival work in grad school, I worked with the Museum of Popular Culture in Seattle. They had an exhibit called
Oh yeah.
what was it called? Indie Game Revolution. And I did, yeah, I said I made these archival packages. And one thing we did is we recorded complete playthroughs of the game. And it was, yeah, totally insufficient in terms of pure preservation. But it's also a lot better than nothing. If
Yeah,
you're at least
yeah.
sort of trying to understand these as artifacts, I could watch someone play the original Super Mario Brothers. And while I would miss a lot about what makes it special in terms of how responsive that jump is, you'd
Right.
still at least get a sense of what it was doing.
Yeah. It's preserving something about
Yeah.
it.
And this comes
Interesting.
up a lot with, we talk about, we're talking about preserving single player games, but then it's like, how do you preserve EverQuest? How do you preserve these games that inherently require an active online community for anyone to have the experience? And even if you preserved EverQuest's world and its game mechanics in a server, you walking around Norrath by yourself is not EverQuest,
Yeah.
And so there are some things where I think the hard truth of preservation is that you cannot preserve everything, and some things will be lost and will only be recorded in people's stories of what it was like.
That's very, very interesting. Yeah, you mentioned, I think, that a game, or rather a book about sort of multiplayer games, massively multiplayer online games especially, would be, something you'd want. And I think that those books are out there, but generally they're like pretty academic, pretty hard to track down if you're not like versed in that world. And they're probably written from a very theoretically heavy perspective of some sort, which, while understandable, is a little bit annoying if your theoretical perspective might differ in some important
Well,
ways.
and it's just, yeah, and I think MMOs have, especially in the academy, been one of the more studied parts of games because they're so interesting, and there's so much particularly people going in this sort of essentially shared role play environment and the communities that form in them. But it is very, I guess I would say, hard to nail down,
Yeah.
and ephemeral. And there's sort of the side note that after World of Warcraft, you had a lot of MMOs just be like, well, that was really successful, so we'll do that. And what seemed like this genre with sort of infinite promise from 2004 to today is mostly variations on World of Warcraft.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of interest in like esports and such, but yeah, a lot of it kind of boils down to like, okay, but who can, kill the most people and be the most strategic, and that's just not For me, at least, that's not fun to watch, but
Yeah.
maybe it's just not my kind of game. I'm not
Yeah,
sure.
well, and even esports, it's never gotten larger than a niche following. And I
Yeah.
think part of that, I mean, there's some endless debates about why this is, but part of that is that, I can watch a game of, soccer slash football, the most popular game in the world, and it's very easy to understand what is happening. You don't have to tell me the rules, right? There's a ball. They're trying to get it between these two goals, right? And you can follow that ball up and down the field and understand what is happening, right? Whereas if you say someone, people think that League of Legends has one of the, or Dota 2 have great, deep mesh. But if you show someone that, you say, what's happening? And you have to know all the characters, and you have to know, oh, well, he's in the middle lane, and that's really important because the jungle creeps. I can't even use the lingo properly. I barely understand it, and I think a lot of games have that difficulty to watch, to say nothing about, I think that in some ways sports culture becomes before sports. If you could take football and completely change the rules of the game and still call it football and have the same iconography, and most people would enjoy it just as much.
So this gets to the kind of ritual quality around games, which again, there's like anthropological literature about this sort of thing, but I guess I'm just curious what you think about the different ways that people engage with games, right? Like, so there's on sort of one end of the spectrum, maybe a highly academic approach, and then at the other end of the spectrum, sort of just playing for fun, something like a kid would do or whatever. I guess I'm curious, like, how do you see games going forward appealing to or sort of playing off those different approaches on the part of the audience, of the players, basically?
I think of games as having two primary appeals to people. And one of them is escapism. And often, like, particularly when people were writing critically or dismissively about games, escapism was used like it was a dirty word, right? Like, oh, you're escaping from, the real world, which is where you should be responsible. But I actually think escapism is a beautiful thing. And I have really liked it when I've had hard times in my life that I can basically leave this world, spend an hour or two in this other world with its own rules, and where, one thing that video games do give you is, because the world is built around you, the player, you have a lot more control than you do in the real world. And you can solve, someone can come to you and say, oh, I have this terrible problem. You say, I will solve the problem. And then you solve the problem, right?
Ace
Which
Attorney.
is not really how things usually go in the real world. And I think that's really nice to be able to have something that's sort of, in their way, very positive and affirming, right? This is like the positive side of that power fantasy.
Yes.
And so I think there will always be a need for that. And people, will watch novels and sorry, watch novels, read novels and watch TV, for the same purposes of kind of escape. But video games have the extra feeling of making you feel like a central part, like you're doing something good. One thing that people have noticed is that, there's a lot of RPGs that kind of, they have like a good playthrough and an evil playthrough, right?
Yes.
And no more than 8% of the players will actually do the evil playthrough. Almost everybody does good. Even if it's, and they say, there's one developer, Josh Sawyer, who's done a lot of RPGs, saying the main point of the evil options is to serve in contrast to the good options. The good options would mean nothing if you didn't at least have the choice of evil. But it does, but that is the ultimate fantasy for people, which I guess says something nice about people in general, if you
I
think
think
about it, that
so,
people
yeah.
really do want to do good. But in real life, it often feels impossible to do so. Like, there are so many obstacles and things are so compromised that how do I do that, or do I have the power to do that? So I think that, anyway, it's a long way to say I think that will always be an appeal. And the second one is shared spaces. Often we talk about today about, the need for third spaces, right? Cafes or meeting places that people can
Yes.
go. But for a lot of people, and particularly younger people, and we really saw this during the pandemic, that shared space can be video games. That you join together wherever you are, you come together in a virtual world and hang out together.
Yeah.
And one thing that was really funny with Fortnite is when they first made Fortnite, right? I mean, first it was like this sort of weird construction survival game. Then they had the spin-off Fortnite Battle Royale, which was intended to be like a very competitive game, right? Last man standing, to the death. And it turned out most players just kind of used it to hang out. They played the game and they did that, but that wasn't really about winning or losing. It was about having a shared space to spend time with their friends. And I
Interesting.
think video games still have, I mean, just have a lot of promise. And, you know, we say video games, but of course, you know, if you ask, you know, Facebook, they call that the metaverse, right? And there's all these things talking about this big shared space, and, you know, and it can get kind of scary when you're like shared virtual offices, and you're like, uh-oh, you know, that's not what I want for my
No,
video games.
thanks.
But you know, and I guess that gets a little bit to what, to the funny thing about video games is that all these decades later, we call them video games, but really we just mean virtual spaces on a computer that you can interact with or navigate in some way. And some of those will be games and some of them won't be. And, you know, the argument as to what does and not do, does not qualify as a video game can get very tiresome very quickly. But it is this medium where it's still not really clear what the boundaries are, you know, what the outside fringes are that we're still figuring out.
That's actually really making me think about Tolkien. Has a talk on fairy stories. Are you familiar with it? Where you're talking about escapism is kind of one of the last topics he kind of comes around to. And when you describe the metaverse, I get, you know, a little bit shivers, but I do think like, okay, no, it can be turned around because if we're escaping from the real world into games, we can just as well escape from games back into the real world. It goes both directions. And I want to say that there's a vertical element to it as well as the horizontal element, if that makes sense, which I think he's tapping into, and I think you are too.
There's a like economics blogger named Noah Smith who, you know, sometimes people say everyone gets kind of one viral tweet. And his viral tweet was, you know, when we were growing up, we went to the internet to escape the real world, and now we go to the real world to escape the internet. You know, and yeah, and that very much could end up, you know, that's kind of the dark path, is that we end up with virtual spaces and video games so dominant that we need to take a break from them. You know, particularly if you think about, you know, things like kind of remote work, where it's like, I need to, you know, I don't want to sit here and play games on my computer because that's where I just spent my whole work day. You know?
Well, can I ask you, what do you do for work these days? Are you still a technical writer, still doing the writing thing?
I was until recently a librarian, actually, a public librarian,
Cool.
which I did for many years and really enjoyed. And I've now, for family reasons, moved back to Seattle where I'm from. And so now I'm trying to figure out what my next step is, because I would love to be a librarian, but in any given place, there's only one public library and a few colleges. So you generally have to try to look at, you know, so it could be project management, it could be technical writing. Yeah, that's not, I'm working on that right now,
Right on.
but it is nice to be in a place that feels like it has, you know, so many opportunities and that I also have such a history with.
Sure. Well, you know, like I said, we are not that far apart. So one of these days when we're in town, I'll try to look you up and maybe we can get together and meet
That
in
sounds
real
great.
life, and play some games and whatnot. I think that'd be super cool. So thanks again for taking all this time to talk about your book and I wish you the best with everything.
Oh,
Thanks.
you as well.
Okay. Till next time.
Next time.